This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Introduced to you, but let's look at Acts chapter 9, where we really see some prominent things happen here with a guy named Saul, who you of course know by another name, but we'll have plenty of time to call him by that name and talk about him as that person. But here he is as Saul. That's how we meet him, isn't it? We meet him as this zealous Jewish man named Saul. And so it says in Acts chapter 9, "But Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way..." What's that, by the way? The way. This is one of those little terms we get in the early stages of Acts to refer to this movement of the Christians. This is the early church. "So that if he found any belonging to that, the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Now as he went on his way, he approached Damascus." This is where he was going. He headed for those synagogues in Damascus. He's trying to get there. "But suddenly, a light from heaven shone around him. And falling to the ground, he heard a voice saying to him, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' And he said, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said, 'I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But arise and enter the city. You will be told what you are to do.' The men who were traveling with him stood speechless, hearing the voice, but seeing no one. Saul rose from the ground, and although his eyes were opened, he saw nothing. So that they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. And for 3 days he was without sight, and he neither ate nor drank." This is God's word, an account of a man. This is the man, of course, known to history as Paul. This man, Paul, is hailed as a great pioneer, isn't he? A great pioneer for his years as a missionary, as a guy who fearlessly crossed over borders, planting churches everywhere, teaching, writing with great apostolic authority. So we hail him as all things, rightly so, it's all true. But he was a pioneer in another way in his younger days, as we read here. He was a pioneer, all right, before all that stuff. And so here we meet him not as Paul, great apostle, missionary, theologian, writer, evangelist, apologist, traveler, so on and so forth. Here we meet him as Saul, the persecutor. He's the persecutor. Before he was all those things, he was persecutor. That was on his early resume. You'll hear a lot of sermons about Paul as the great example that he was, right? In so many of those other areas I just mentioned, an example of someone with boldness, willing to go out for, you know, face up to whatever challenges and challengers, to stand before great men in authority, to preach and proclaim the truth to whatever audience, wherever, whatever they might do to him. All of that is rightly so. All of that is rightly so, to preach and teach about Paul in those ways and set him as a great example. But this is a little bit different, because here we have a sermon about Saul as the pioneer of Christian persecutors. And obviously, he is not to be emulated in this. This is not an example that you want anybody to follow. But he is still an example of something. Not an example in the sense that you ought to try to emulate, but a case study. You know what I mean? An example in that sense. Something we have to note and understand. We've said a lot of times that the book of Acts, so much of the book of Acts is like a template. You know what I mean? It's like the skeletal structure of what is to come. It's prophetic in so many ways. So we say it's a template for the church's future in all kinds of ways. And unfortunately, what I have to say to you here, when we meet the great persecutor, is that what we see, especially in the first two verses there, unfortunately, that is also a template. That's also a precedent of the future of the church, that there will be persecution. Those first two verses right there, they are no exception to that principle. Now, I'll just remind you of something we did a few weeks ago when I sort of introduced you to Saul of Tarsus. So just I'll remind you of the points I made then by just repeating myself a little bit, because it won't matter to you. You forgot. If you were here, you forgot. That was a few weeks. I mean, you know, a lot of preachers could get by with doing the same sermons like several times over and over. Just space it out a little bit. As long as it's not back to back, a lot of people won't even notice. But not me, except for in this case. Here, in this case, I do want to remind you, because I want to just come back to who is this guy? If you missed, by the way, if you missed that, a more in-depth introduction to who Saul is, his background, where he's from, everything we can know about him, that also is available. Go to the website, go find it, you can listen to that. But I'm going to remind you here of who this guy is. Remember we said he was a man who represented all the important influences of his time, because he's clearly Jewish, right? He's clearly Greek in his culture because of the city that he grew up in, and he's Roman legally and officially as a citizen. So basically, here's the same slide I showed you then. All I did is cut the slide and paste the slide, all right? And so it's the same guy, Greek, Jewish, Roman. He was raised in the strict Jewish household. He was sent as a teenager to study under the leading rabbi and Pharisee, Gamaliel. He was raised in a city that was distinguished for its Greek learning and culture. He spoke the common Greek fluently. He knew about the Greek philosophers, all their theories. He could quote them, and he did. And he had this very distinct privilege of Roman citizenship. And that's why I said he was Jewish, he was Greek, he was Roman. That's why he encompasses those three in all those different unique ways, and I expanded on that. But what we see now as a reminder here in these first two verses that we saw, what we see is what this man was doing at the time we get him here, what he's up to here. And it's no good, because he's now this guy with this background and all that he's got going for him. And Saul has a lot going for him. I mean, he would be among the elite in the different circles he would go in, because he's got, if he's among the Jews, why, he's on top of that pyramid, because he's a trained rabbinical Pharisee who knows the scriptures and all that. So he's at the top of that social order. If he's out among the Greeks, he's no second classer there. He knows their culture very well. He can speak that fluently, so he can operate in that. And if he's among Roman citizens, he's also not second class. He could say just as well as anybody, I'm a Roman citizen too. So he has a lot going for him. And what is he using all that for right now? He's using it, as we encounter him here in these first two verses, he's using all that in a new career as a persecutor. At this moment, if he had a business card, he would say, Saul, persecutor. By the way, business cards, for those of you, never mind. It's a thing people used to carry in the pre-digital age. It was a little card, it had stuff on it. Saul, breathing threats and murder, it said in that first verse. How about that? Breathing threats and murder. That didn't sound good at all. And what's he doing in those verses? He's requesting legal permission to go and do his bidding. You know, it can sometimes surprise us. I don't know if it ever surprises you, but I think it does. A lot of Christians today are sometimes surprised at just how much some people really hate the church. And they really actively want to thwart whatever she's doing. And they want to undermine Christian influence. There are some people that it's almost hard to understand. I don't know about you, but sometimes I think, wow, what are Christian people and what are churches doing exactly, you know, all around the world to earn such acrimony, just this sort of bitter dislike and this disdain with, oh, these Christians and these churches. Some people just hate the church, and it's sometimes it boggles the mind to think, why is this? So these followers of Jesus here in the early going in Acts, they've done, think about it, they've done no violence to anyone. Okay, thus far you have this body of people and they have not done any violence. They've stolen nothing. They're not engaged in operations to put anybody down or keep anybody down. There's nothing directly inflammatory against the church, like their master, like the man they're named after, like the person whose teaching they follow. This early church was, you know, pretty well innocent. I mean, there was not much of a legitimate charge to bring against this church. They hadn't done anything really all that wrong, had they? And for all that, their message, though, that they proclaimed, their message challenged what someone like young Saul. Young Saul, who, I mean, you know, he's so well educated, right? And he's such a smart guy. And he feels like he's been taught and he knows stuff. And who are these people with their beliefs and their views? And they're not my views and I don't agree with them. And the fact is, this is usually the case. This is typically what we have. You know, in a lot of parts of the world today, for someone to convert, for someone to become a Christian, means that the Christian message is actually being effective, right? The gospel is being proclaimed and people are believing it. And where you have that in lots of places in the world, people get angry. And it can be dangerous. And why? What is it? What is it about that dynamic that will anger people? Well, it involves a change in the fundamental beliefs of people, which involves the challenging of other beliefs. You know, a lot of times we think about the spiritual warfare of the world. And we can sometimes see it always just in the most Hollywood-like, in our minds, the most theatrical spiritual battles. You know, we see in our minds unseen, you know, forces, these giant battles. We sometimes don't notice, though, that part of the spiritual battle is in the realm of ideas and truth and who believes what messages. That is a primary front in the spiritual warfare. That's why they talk about the strongholds, tearing down the strongholds of beliefs, falsehoods, false teachings and ideas that wreck people's lives because they're not true. Because what is the enemy as much as anything? Liar. Deceiver. This is repeatedly what he is called. So he's engaged in fooling people. And so if you challenge beliefs that have a hold on people, you're making waves. You're causing trouble. And there is, in many places, in many cases, zero tolerance for that kind of thing. Zero tolerance. If people are embracing these new beliefs, these ideas, such as the Lordship of Christ, salvation by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone, is something that will cause hatred to be aroused. And in our society, you know, look, thankfully, you still, so far, have the freedom to believe whatever you want. Nevertheless, even in our society, which you should be very glad that this freedom is enshrined and that you can believe what you like and say so. Nevertheless, there's still an extreme animosity toward people whose beliefs are not approved. Right? And if your beliefs are not approved, then you're not going along. And disagreement with that can be deemed intolerant. And sometimes punishment awaits you for that sort of thing. And at its worst, these days especially, you know, thanks to, I think there are various causes for it, but the internet's one of them, and the anonymity that it provides. There is a strain of this that can be as mean and nasty and vile as any opposition that you could see. Now, if you're not familiar with that and you don't go and you don't see those kind of things, hey, good for you. Save yourself the trouble of seeing just how low people can go with how mean and nasty and terrible they are. And they can be that way toward people who have done nothing more than politely state their beliefs. Why, you mean simply politely stating beliefs you hold that happen to disagree with them? Why, surely no one would be mad at you for that. Yeah. Not only mad at you, but I mean, they can want to destroy you. There are patterns to persecution that we often see. Now, Saul does something in this passage. Saul makes this a legal affair, doesn't he? He makes it legal. He goes to the authorities. He works with the authorities to get their sanction or permission to go arrest the Christians. There's some background here. It's a little bit of historical background to help you understand what's happening in those verses. So we're told by the historians that the Roman Empire, the imperial government, had granted the Jews, all right, the Jews, they operate the land around Israel, the land of Palestine. Now, they didn't get to operate it fully, but I mean, like, they were given, you know, the ability to kind of have their religious culture and society and have their temple and have their different sectarian groups and teach their law, right? They were allowed to do this and have temple worship, even though, you know, they were under the Roman jurisdiction. But they got to operate in that way, and they had been allowed to do that to a degree under the Greeks before. And there were certain privileges that they had been given as that an independent state might enjoy. And one of the privileges that a state has, and some of these were just grandfathered in from former times, the Greek leaders had given the Jews this right. And one of them was a right that we sometimes call extradition, sort of a political term. Are you familiar with the notion of extradition? Nations today. You read about this at times in news stories. Nations today sort of mutually recognize this in each other. Nations will recognize the right of another nation to ask you, hey, somebody is guilty of a terrible crime, and then they ran off. You know what I mean? It's like, not to overly simplify, but it's like if your kid did something really bad and then ran off to the neighbor's house to hide from you. You call up the neighbors and say, my boy over there? Yeah, he's here. Send him home. That's what they're doing. Extradition is nations recognize that if a fugitive who's done something really bad is trying to hide from his responsibility legally in your country, you send him home to go answer for that. Sometimes it gets tricky, of course. The country of destination, though, will sometimes go and arrest that person to send them back to the country of origin. That's extradition. The Jews at one point had been given this right under the Greeks. There was a brief time the Jews had independence. You know, they had that whole revolt, you know, and the Maccabees and all that. And they had a brief period of independence. And this is on record that there are letters that they have on record, historians have, where it shows, you know, the Egyptians would say, you know, we're going to send back this guy that, you know, did something terrible in your temple or something like that. And you can try him there. What is Saul asking for here? That's what he wants. He wants the legal permission to go after these Christians who have left. Why'd those Christians leave, by the way? Because it's getting hot around there. They're trying to not get killed. They've already seen what happens. They saw what happened to Stephen, and they see that the heat's getting turned up. So they leave. But Saul says, no, no, no. It's not good enough for me that I just ran them out. That I ran them out of here. That's not good enough. I want to go hunt them down. I want to drag them back here and throw them behind bars. So give me permission to do it. Let's make it legal. Let me go get them, but let me wear a badge when I'm doing it. So let me have the power of the official government behind me. He wanted to go bring back these Christians. And this exhibits the pattern that I'm referring to here. Look, Saul had never been done wrong by any of these Christians, had he? Had any of the Christians done anything to him? Nothing. Nothing at all. Nevertheless, he feels a kind of hatred against them because they believe things that challenge his beliefs. He doesn't like what they believe. He thinks they're wrong. And it's not enough that he thinks they're wrong. He thinks they should be shut down. And it's not enough that he thinks they should be shut down socially. Like, I'm going to go out there and tell everyone they're wrong. Saul could have gone out there and challenged him openly and said, hey, everybody, these guys over here preaching this stuff, they're wrong. Don't believe them. He could have done that. Now, that's not good enough. Not good enough. You've got to shut them down by force. So, in his zeal against them, he's going to go and use the power of the state against them. He's going to say the government I'll get them on my side, and then we can really put the screws to these Christians. Do you know that in a lot of parts of the world, at least some parts, there are officially, legally speaking, there are anti-conversion laws. These exist. That is, enshrined in the law codes, right there, like with, you know, you can't steal people's property and, you know, stuff like that, will be that you are forbidden by law to convert to Christianity. Like, you will stay the belief that you were told to be and you'll not change. Now, incidentally, can there ever really be a law passed that could really keep somebody from converting? That's not really possible, because laws can't. There's no law that can prevent what I think, believe, and commit myself to. The law can't get inside your heart and mind and say, yo, no, you can't believe that. Just like the law can never keep people from praying. You can't make your brain do anything. Can't make your heart and mind, they can't get in those places. However, these anti-conversion laws can bring, what they really can do though, what they really serve to do, is not to really keep people from converting, but to punish those who do. To punish those who it's known do, that is. To punish anyone who visibly shows the signs that, hey, you became one of those, and now you're in big trouble. Well, where are these kind of places? Well, we say this a lot of time, but I would encourage you regularly to keep up with what goes on in the world. The Voice of the Martyrs, these kind of organizations. You can keep up with it. This helps you to understand what's happening in the world, to stand with brothers and sisters, to pray for them, to be aware of it. And you will see when you read those kinds of things how these things play out. And in many lands, some of them are dominated by Islam. Some of them, though, are other places. There are some states of India where Hindus have passed this. Yes, true. Hindus have passed in some of the states of India. India has states. And in the southern area where they have more control, more radical Hindus, they will pass laws, anti-conversion laws. Incidentally, usually the anti-conversion laws in these places are one-way laws, by the way. Because anybody can convert to the dominant religion. I mean, if you're in one of those states and you say, hey, I was raised in that household over there, but I want to become Hindu, there's going to be no law against that. Or if you're in a Muslim country, you can always convert to Islam. No, it's always a one-way. It's always one way. Can you imagine, just flip it, can you imagine any of the, you know, in Europe once upon a time, or in Canada once upon a time, or in the U.S. even now, where Christianity is sort of the dominant professed belief, can you imagine laws being passed that would say, it's okay if any of you who are not Christian want to become Christians, that's fine. But if any of you who have said you are Christians ever say that you're going to be something else, you'll go to jail. Can you imagine that? You can't imagine. All of you born and raised here, you can't imagine that. You say, that's silly. I could never be. But that's how life is in some places. And fellow Christians live in those places. And missionaries, imagine their work. How's that? How's that for your mission work? Please, hear the gospel. Respond to the gospel. Repent and believe. And go to jail if you do. Come, be baptized, and possibly killed for it if they find out, depending on where and how strict. And so the same pattern we see here with Saul often is the case where Christians have done no one harm, no one. They're in places operating, just going about their business. They're not stealing people's property and doing terrible things on the side and causing trouble and physically going out and assaulting people, roving gangs of these minority Christians out there. Most of these places, I mean, they're just model citizens. They're just trying to keep their nose down and, you know, they're not trying to overthrow the government. And yet they'll be despised because of what they believe and proclaim. Because of what they believe and proclaim, and it challenges those strongholds of beliefs, those ideas. And it's not enough just to oppose them with words. It's not enough just to go out publicly and call them names. It's not enough just to maybe use the power of media against them. No, you've got to use force. You've got to use the law. You've got to use the state against them. And so we see it. This, by the way, Lotus, the date on this. This is from the BBC. And it's 3 days ago. 2 days ago? Yeah. 2 days ago, no less. And it's and so it's to a British audience from a British point of view, but they're saying, look, this, it's almost hard to believe. 1 in 3 people in the world suffering from religious persecution, and Christians, quote, are the greatest or the most persecuted religious group, the study found. And this guy says that political correctness is playing a part in the issue not being confronted. Now he's talking about, he's saying the issue not being confronted there in the UK, which is where this is, where this, the audience here. He's saying because of where we live here, readers of this won't know about these things, and they'll think, they'll be surprised by it. Why will they be surprised by it? Well, largely the culture is unaware of this. I can promise you that if you were to go and ask people on the street, everyday people, what religious groups are most persecuted, they will not think it's Christians. They would think, are you crazy? No, surely Islamophobia is what runs rampant, or something along those lines. You know, they would think that because they imbibe a media narrative that sort of makes them think that. If they knew globally the facts of the matter, they would understand what this study shows. And incidentally, you should go find this article and read it, because one of the things this gentleman says, which is so good, is he says, you know, a lot of people in the West, a lot of the British audience and Americans too, one reason they don't want to admit this and they don't like it is because when they imagine, oh, the idea of Christians being persecuted, they think of somehow the most wealthy, privileged Christians in the world or something. And what this man said is what they don't realize is the people whose persecution they ignore and won't write about and won't cover in media are actually some of the poorest people in the world. You know, because in most of the places they're being persecuted, they're the minority. They're at the bottom of the food chain. And so, it happens around the world. Well, on a far lesser scale, though, just so that you can see this applies to you, maybe saying, well, I don't live in those parts of the world. I guess I should pray for those people, but it doesn't really have an effect on me. But to a much lesser degree, here in the land of the free, there is an attempt, at least, at that pattern. See, a lot of persecutors wish they could do those things. The pattern of, I hate you and I can't stand you because of your beliefs, and I'd sure like to punish you for having them, and I'd sure like to use the state if I could. And for many people in our culture, I don't know what the numbers are, but there is a strain, let's say. There's a contingent, and some of them have pretty loud voices and pulpits and positions, you know, and they only wish they could use the power of the state. And if they could, they would. They've shown enough. You can consider there are cases that come through, and even though some of them might look, by comparison to what goes on in other places in the world, it seems a little silly. But just to notice the pattern, just to show you that the pattern is there, consider sort of the well-publicized case of good old Chick-fil-A. And I don't want to make you hungry because I know it's near lunch, but bear with me here. And of course, someone's going to get mad at me because they're closed. I did this once before I mentioned Chick-fil-A, and afterward people are like, thanks for nothing, man, because they're closed today. You had to talk about them, and I can't even go there. Hey, why don't you... you can write your own hate mail to Chick-fil-A for being closed, but you're going to have to get in line because their inbox is full of hate mail already. And they may not get to yours for a while. Why? Why? Why all that hate mail pouring into poor old Chick-fil-A? Well, notice the pattern, though. Look, again, as a company, they've really not done no one any harm, per se. I mean, they, from everything I can tell, they're pretty great to their employees. I've known people who work for them, and I still do know some people who work. They're pretty great to their employees. They seem to be overly polite to all customers, you know. They seem to be just the nicest, swellest people on earth. I mean, it's like, golly gee, can I shine your shoes? Wow. While I make your waffle fries. It's like they're just overly nice, very polite. They don't turn anybody away. It's not like, no, you have too many tattoos. We won't serve you. No, they don't play. They're as nice as they can be, whoever you are. They turn no one away. They're equal opportunities employers, and they give a lot of money to charities to help, you know, homes for boys without, you know, all this. They seem to be doing a lot of good. So, geez, why could anyone really hate their guts so much? Well, you see, back in 2012, there was a hot political topic being talked about everywhere. It was gay marriage. Oh, everyone couldn't talk enough about it. And the media thrives on controversy. And so they're looking to, they want sparks, you know what I mean? They want fireworks. And it was in the middle of a political issue. And so they said, let's go ask the Chick-fil-A guy. Because, you know, when you approach an elderly, lifelong, church-going resident of Georgia, what his beliefs are, gee, I don't know, what do you think they might be when it comes to progressive sexual ethics? What do you think an old Georgia lifelong church-going guy is, what do you think the odds are his beliefs, probably what they probably, they knew what they were. But this will get it going. So, of course, they asked him, what did he say? Did he say, well, I'll tell you who's ruining these countries, these degenerate blah, blah, blah. Did he go on a rant? No rant. No name calling. Nothing so impolite or uncivil or anything. However, he did have the audacity to simply state his views in the simplest, most polite terms. And his views were, now brace yourself for the controversy of this. This is going to blow your doors off. This is edgy stuff. His views were, well, I guess I believe in the age-old biblical traditional views that have been held for centuries by Christians around the world, and for that matter, Jews, Muslims, and the overwhelming majority of all other people on earth. Yeah, those are my views. What? And so those beliefs alone, just to simply being guilty of holding those beliefs and saying it out loud when asked, earned him and the entire company, earned the whole company the scorn and the wrath of those who disagree. And it wasn't enough, though. See, this is the pattern. It wasn't enough just that we hate you for your beliefs. And it wasn't enough that we're going to go to the internet and say, oh, they're terrible, those chicken frying bunch of bigots. It wasn't enough to say that. It wasn't enough. They had to seek actively through organized campaigns where money is spent for years up to now. They had to seek actively to bring the power of the state against this company. And I don't know if you've kept up with it, but in the years since, there have been mayors of cities and city councils and other elected officials who, responding to this pressure, have caved into this pressure and have used their positions of authority to ban that business. You may not have a license to operate here. Burger King, you're cool. Subway, have at it. But not you guys. Not you guys. Even though you would probably generate good jobs and good wealth around here, you seem to know what you're doing. But we can't have you here. You see, the pattern still holds. And it's an innocuous example. I mean, nobody's being burned at a stake here. But it just, do you see the same pattern at work? I hate your beliefs. Therefore, I will go to seek letters by the authorities that I may chase you down where you are and use the power of the government to destroy you if I can. And by the way, some of those acts they've done aren't even probably legal, some authorities have said. So wherever you are, look, whatever level it is, it's sort of like Paula was saying earlier about wherever you, it starts in school and it just goes the rest of your life. It starts in the school days. If you're one of those people and they know you go and join the Christian groups and you go to church every week and you got a youth group and all that, well, that sets you apart. And some people are going to say, well, you're one of those hateful bigots. You got to learn early on how to navigate these waters. But it's not going to end. It's not going to stop. It's not going to end just when you, oh, well, sir, I'll get a little older and I won't have to deal with that kind of stuff anymore. You'll always have to deal with that kind of stuff. If you're a faithful Christian, it'll always be there. It'll take different forms. Well, let's get practical here. I got a few things to say. We learned about Saul, but look, what can we learn? What do we make of persecution? Quickly then. Persecution is not a mistake, brothers and sisters. It is not a mistake. It's not a surprise. It doesn't shock the Lord Himself. He doesn't go, oh no, I hadn't planned on this. I had this whole plan to enact about the church, but I didn't count on all this opposition. No, God's plan is not thwarted by persecution. And it is not a sign that the church is faltering, that the church may not accomplish her goals, that the whole plan might be sabotaged. It's not a sign of that. In fact, you know what? It's a sign of just the opposite. It's just the opposite. It's exactly the opposite because it is expected. Did Jesus not tell His followers this? Did He not tell them how it's going to be? And so Saul then is almost, in doing what Saul does in Acts chapter 9, he's acting out something prophetic. And he is a forerunner of what is to come. A long history of persecution. You know, I like this old quote, and I can't remember now who said it. But he said, if I'm about to set out on a journey to a destination, and if I'm told that the correct way to navigate, the right way to get there, is a very rough road, then when I'm traveling, every bump I feel is going to remind me I'm on the right path. I must be on the right path. I was told this is right. If it's too smooth, I might be nervous I'm not headed the right way. So we were told this. The church doesn't seek persecution. All this being said, we're not trying to get persecuted. There's no sermon ever preached, 5 ways to get persecuted. I'm going to show you in 3 steps. They're all going to rhyme. They'll all start with a T. You know, I'm going to give you a 3-step sermon. Buy my book today. 10 ways to get persecuted today. It's not a how-to. We don't have to seek it, and we shouldn't seek it. We're not trying to get persecuted. We don't have a persecution complex. Now, these two are related, of course. But not only are we not actively trying to be persecuted, we don't have a complex. There are 2 mistakes Christians can make along these lines. Some Christians will do terrible things. I mean, like terrible things. I mean, or just annoying things, you know. Some Christians are hard. They're tough to get along with, you know. I know we don't know any people like that. But some Christians have bad attitudes. Hello. And so people do not like them. So they face certain kinds of persecution. And so you see what I mean? Like they want to get persecuted. They're like, what can I do to make people mistreat me? We're not doing that. If you get persecution because you're a big jerk, why then you deserve that. Don't be a martyr. Don't say, well, it's my cross to bear. After you've, you know, treated people like garbage and they don't like you, well, it's just because of my faith. They just can't accept me. No, don't do that. Don't do that. That's the antithesis of what you ought to be. So you don't have to create it, but nor do we play the victim scene. I don't have to tell you, I think, that we live now in a victim culture. Have you noticed this? We live in a victim culture. This is strange to me, and I would have never thought we would come to this. And I don't know that it's ever been this way before, but there are some people in our society for whom being a victim, somehow being oppressed, is something that is a status symbol. It's a status symbol. Like, I want that as part of my persona. There are people, this is happening more and more, who will spray paint like terrible messages on their own house. Get out of here, Jews! Well, I don't know what. Like, you know, go home, you filthy Mexican! And they're Mexican? I mean, like, there are people who do this to themselves. Look this up. This has been happening. And sociologists and psychologists are trying to figure out, like, what would make people do that? They do it to themselves. But why? Because they do it in order to get the attention that it brings, because it's now considered positive attention. You know, there was a day when if that happened to you, and then the news media might show up and bring cameras, and you'd be like, oh, great. It would be like adding insult to injury. Like, it's bad enough that I've been treated this way. Now everybody's got to see my face, and I got to talk about it. But now everyone's like, yeah. Like, when the cameras show up, the person is well-dressed and ready. Got a smile on. You're late. I expected you here an hour ago. They've got a speech prepared. Because it's like, this is a positive thing for me. Christians do not, we must not, join this game. This is a twisted, bizarre, and weird game. Do not participate in the oppression Olympics. You know, Christians don't want to play holier than thou, the Pharisaical, I'm holy. But part of that is the more persecuted than thou, more oppressed than thou. Don't play that game either. That's the new Phariseeism. Well, I'm more oppressed than you. No, you're not. And nowadays, everyone's trying to stack their credentials. You know what I mean? Like, the more categories of oppression I have, I'm better than you. And this is really convoluted. Christians ought not do it. Let there never, please, be any Christians who it's found out concocted a persecution story against themselves. I hope that never happens. You know, like the guy that pays his friends to commit a hate crime against him. Here's $20. Slap me around. don't do it. Don't do it. We don't play the victim. We are not called also to lash out. I mean, does this really even need to be said? When we read about the persecuted church, when we hear about what's going on in society, you must resist the urge to do what the flesh would tell you to do, which is let's go tell them, you know. We can't do that. There is no way on this earth, I don't care how creatively you interpret, there is no way on earth to read through the Gospels and come to any conclusion like, go therefore and kick a little rear end anytime they start to persecute you. You cannot derive that from the red letters of the teachings of Jesus. I mean, if there's one thing that this is impossible for any reasonable person to conclude, it's that Jesus has called you to go get revenge on them. Go take care of business. No. Now, this, by the way, does that mean that you don't answer for yourself? No. Every time the apostles are tried, do they say, well, you know, whatever you guys want to do. No, they stood up for themselves. They said, no, we haven't committed any crime. You know what I'm saying? There's a difference. You're not just rolling over. You speak the truth. You defend yourself in court or including public opinion. But you don't go take revenge. Listen, this is a reminder to us, this message here, to never forget, as I said, about the persecuted church. Don't ever forget that this is going on. In all of Paul's letters he would later write, this former persecutor, Paul, always reminded the church to remember certain people, didn't he? You read those letters? Don't forget about our brother over here. Remember the Christians over here. Like, he wanted, remember to pray for them. He of all people knew about this because he had been a persecutor and then he became the persecuted. So they're always in our prayers. Don't ever forget them. The church should never be guilty of this. At all times and places, if Christians become a majority anywhere, they cannot play this game ever. Even, by the way, this is hard, but even in your own households, Christian families sometimes think, I will forbid my kid to ever believe anything else. And the kid's 23 years old. And the harsh truth is, you can't use other means. I'll bribe them into being a Christian. Won't work. I'll threaten them into being a Christian. Won't work. That's illegitimate. There is only one legitimate way for people to truly be converted, and that's through the power of the Holy Spirit, only by our words, as we proclaim and they genuinely believe it. We don't use force. We must never try to use the government in this way. Ever. So that's a lesson to us. And remember, look, always, this will end on the most positive note, because you might think this message is a downer, man, talking about all this persecution. But remember this, Al. The good news is the gates of hell will not prevail.